Hello and welcome everybody to Masterclass. Today is May 25th, 2023, and we do have a large group of presenters this evening. They're all trying to catch up after they go, right? I mean, we have some that are leaving on the 30th, so we definitely have to get some of these presentations done and out of the way. So, but I'm always looking forward to them, and I hope you are all too. Let's go ahead and start tonight with Srikanth, if you are ready.
Yes, I'm ready. Hope you are able to hear me. Let me
Yes, I can
quickly
hear
share my
you.
screen.
All right.
Okay, awesome, fantastic. Let me place this in presentation mode and then share my screen. Okay. Oops. I think let me clear all my recordings. Okay. Thank you for the initial hiccups. So good evening and good morning to everyone. Today we're going to talk about Azure Data Storage Services. This is one of the interesting topic I wanted to bring here because storage is being one of the very common commodity these days. We have seen days where we used to talk about kilobytes in terms of the floppy, and then it moved on to disks, then the HDD disks, then the spinning disks, then the HDD disks, then it moved on to cloud storages, then including the commodity enterprise, everything like commodity, like you started having Gmail, or today you have Dropbox or Apple Storage, anything. But now things move beyond that with the cloud storages, and the most common is the storage accounts or AWS account storages, S3 buckets. But today I wanted to specifically bring out there is something beyond these things within this journey, because it went on from kilobytes to gigabytes to terabytes, and now it's petabytes and it's close to exabytes. So I wanted to actually come and show that what options we have and how the technology have enabled by within the Azure to cater the storage needs for every use case, not just the generic use case what we generally do. It's much more beyond of that. With that, the agenda would be the Azure storage redundancy, then the Azure storage account, Azure NetApp files, and Azure Cloud Volume ONTAP, that CVO, and Azure Managed Lustre file system. So let's start with the Azure storage redundancy. The reason before even I wanted to talk about the storages, I wanted to really talk about the bring everyone up to speed on the redundant options that are available in Azure. Because by default today we have all of us have data disks, pen drives, or laptops, or in some other form we use storage. And redundancy, resiliency, and copies is always a question mark. Like you need to have a recovery because we have our memories, we have our crucial data, we have our research, everything. By default, in cloud, when you take a storage, by default, you would have three cards. That's one other major small mess everybody have. And that's why you should always preferable to go to cloud today, whether you do with Apple or you do with Google or any services, including Azure, you have multiple copies by default because you wanted the durability, availability, and all these things. So in Azure, that kind of provision by default provision is called local redundant storage. You would have three copies. They won't charge you for three copies. It's just included. It's a hidden figure. You would get it. But only thing is that it comes from single data center. And then the other one is the next level of availability is zone redundant storage. That means it's again distribution of the copies, but it is available across three different data centers. Why this is one thing is that it provides you high availability from data center failures, power failures, and all these things. But also when you within the country, when you wanted to keep within the date within the country, but at the same time you wanted to safeguard your data against local country level failures like a earthquake at one site, this actually provides. While these two are the minimum basic options what we have today, but one thing you have to also understand is from the availability point of view. Even though it's three copies, it's one of the highest availability timelines that is available in Azure. That is local LRS actually provides 11 nines of availability. Like if I can tell you, 9 nines is like 31.56 milliseconds of downtime, whereas 5 nines is like 5 minutes, 26 minutes of downtime in a year. So here we're talking about 11 nines of availability. And whereas TDRS is 12 nines within the country, and it keeps going. That is a kind of availability redundancy is what we are talking in storages. So that means when the more we put our data, the more we consume, these are the foundations of on which the whole concept of cloud has been built. So it is very much important for us to understand these what options we have so that we can use these storages according to what we have, because the more the features that it provides, the cost is added to it. Right. With that, the next one is the geo-redundant storages and read access geo-redundant storage and geo-zone redundant storage and read access geo-zone redundant storage. So this is like one level above these. Geo-redundant storage is actually a replica of local redundant storage. Like that means you would have six copies, but they are spread across two different regions, continent itself, and you still have data available there, right? And it got two variants. One is like you would always have a read-only copy mounted on the other secondary site, but it's a little expensive. But this op, you can say, okay, I'll only bring it up when during a disaster, to keep your costs low. And the other one, the highest one, is the geo-zone redundant storage. It provides maximum consistency, durability, availability, performance, and resilience from the disaster recovery. And also it provides 16 nines of availability. That's like microseconds, right? With these as our background, as a foundation for the storage, let's move on to the storage options, what we have. So there are multiple storage options, okay, in Azure itself. There's the standard general purpose two. There's a purpose one, but now it is the latest one is the purpose two. You would have, under that category, you would have blob storage, data lake, queue storage, and table storage, and Azure files. Blob storage are basically an unstructured storage. You would have, it is actually used for regular all-purpose purposes, and data lake is something where you have used for large analytics. Like you wanted to have exabytes of data stored at one place, but you wanted to analyze that data, crunch the data, regularly understand, mine the data, right? That's where the data lake comes in, and the back end, the foundation of the data lake is blob storage. Whereas the queue storage is basically is the storage that is for messages, where you wanted to specifically in the use cases where it's like an SMS service, or you wanted to provide a status and all these things. Table storages are for simplified tables and all these things. And Azure files are the regular file storage, but it's a single protocol, whether you want an SMB or you want an NFS, those kind of things. Okay. This is the basic storage is what we had. Even in blob, even though it is basic, you have three more categories of blob storage, that is hot, cool, and archive, because of you wondered if you are you want to keep huge amount of data which you don't want to access for long term. That means for forensics or for legal purpose, you want to store it for 7 years, 10 years. Archive is the right thing to do. But the only thing is that your retrieval should be less than 180 days, or else your retrieval cost would be more than the cost of the storage. And if it is like, if you want to keep keep down the cost, but you want to store, you want to retrieve it in every 30 days, then cool storage is the one. But if you want to do it for regular purposes, it's a hot storage. So there are multiple options. So it's one, the architect who is designing the solution have to understand all these things and pick up the right storage, because everything at the end of the day, it implies to the cost and the performance. So since the storage being the foundation for anything what you do in the cloud, the cloud service providers provided multiple options. So these are the one of the options. Now, this is for the basic applications with multiple options. Let's see the premium applications like IoT, interactive AML, then the data visualization, e-commerce, data processing pipelines, real streaming, on all these things. They use the blob, premium blob storage. The only difference between these and these is like it's a backend disk type. It's like, whereas this is a regular standard HDD, whereas this is a premium disk and all those things. Moving on to the premium file shares, this is for where you want a single file shares, where you want to replace on-premises single protocol shares like the CIFS, SMB file shares on Windows, NFS file shares on Linux. So for those, you can actually use this. The only option which is not there on this is multi-protocol, which I will bring in a I'll explain a product which supports that. But this is a good one at a lower cost where you wanted to, it's in a small company or a small business unit where you are working on a project and you want to collaborate. People actually, it provides an ability to create and share, which is mappable across your computers or across the network. And the last one is the premium page blobs. This is a foundation for your Azure disks, virtual disks, what you have. It's a collection of 512 bytes, which provides the ability to read, write, arbitrary range of bytes. And it's also the backbone of SQL DB. You know, today in the past, if you have to install an SQL database, you bring up in Windows Server, you install the SQL and create a database, and you attach on all these things. But today in Azure, you have a database as a service. So you can actually straight away get a database, but the foundation for that is this. You know, they create the whole thing. They create the database on these page blobs and give you access to that. So I think most of us would have seen these, but I wanted to quickly recap and bring everyone up to speed on because these are the general ones, and 90%, 95% of the services what people bring up actually use this. Okay. Now the next one which I'm going to talk about is that the enterprise, like large scales, where people are moving to have huge file storages from NetApp, EMC, or Hitachi, Dell, or HP. There are like five, six vendors in the storage space, in the storage world, with, where they provide huge enterprise-based storages. Where storage doesn't come from a server, rather you would have a storage. Now, as people are moving away from on-premises, they were looking for that level of enterprise storages options in cloud. And Azure, you know, partnered with NetApp. Basically, they partnered together and provided this option in Azure. So why should enterprises or anybody have to actually go and use this when the other ones, the ones which we have seen, the previous ones are available? One thing is it's multi-protocol. Yeah, these, because multi-protocol is something which is very, very helpful, where you have a multi-complex environment or you develop a software, you develop it for Windows, you develop for Unix, because there are everybody uses different operating systems. So in that, but they would people don't want to actually keep collaborate on two different file systems. So one would create a single file system and enable SMB and NFS on these file systems and access across with single identity or multiple identity. Multiple identity means you can have Unix identity identity, you can have Windows identity, you can use and protocol RFC 2307. It's an AD level protocol, and you can integrate that into the storage and still use this. So these are the real-time applications, application of these high-level storages. Guys, believe me, I've seen this. I've worked on these kind of enterprise storages over the years, and they bring in huge, huge difference the way enterprises work. And also, other thing is tiering. Okay, tiering is the other one. Even though you would have, you want that high capability, you can't have that much high performing storage with these features because it's too expensive. So the technologies enable auto tiering. That means if you give low different tiers of storage, this Azure NetApp or this the algorithm, what it can do is that it based the policy you set, it will identify files older than age of that age and move it back to lower tier so that you don't end up in paying higher costs for a huge amount of data which you won't retrieve on a regular basis. But at the same time, you get higher performance for the shorter thing, right? So, and also on the deeper integration, you want to integrate seamlessly with Azure AD, Azure services like the AKS or functions, or you want to build up an application. Azure NetApp Files is a good one. And also it's simplified storage. You don't have to do anything. All you have to do is go ahead, go to your subscription, search for, let me show you if I can have, I think I have it. So this is like Azure NetApp Files. You go, you just create, you give a resource group, and you select the location. Let me see if I can change the subscription. All right. So it actually straightforward created. Okay. It's so simple. So, whereas in the past, if we have to bring in enterprise storage, you have to order it. First of all, it's too expensive, and it would take at least 3 months to ship it. And then it would take a couple of engineers. I used to do that in my past, where we used to get dedicated huge boxes with arrays of racks and all these things. Now, ta-dang, you just get a high performance storage like that. Right. In this, it also provides three different options. One is standard, premium, and ultra, and it's all depends on the performance needs, what you want, and all these things. So you would have these options super good. So it's just that you create a capacity volume, you add a pool, you can add a straightforward, and as I said, standard, premium, ultra, and you create once you create the capacity volumes, and you create sort of capacity pools, and you create volumes and start using it. It's that simple. Okay. The reason why I want to stress is that this have changed the way the enterprises operate. Okay. And it's so good. Now, what is the drawback of this? One of the drawback of this is it requires certain networking backbones. It requires certain regional availabilities, and it's a storage that is being made available now, but it requires some more time. For that, what they actually came up as the NetApp CVO. Basically, it's an ONTAP. It's just a replica of what you have on premises. Okay. Before we actually talk about this, one thing is that, okay, as I said, it's so simple because earlier, if at all you have an storage on-prem, you have to have to manage the hardware, manage the on-tap upgrades, software upgrades, manage the performance because you need to create volumes, you need to slice them, you need to say under from which enclosure you would get the disk and from how many disks you got to use and what RAID you got to use, all those things. The solution, storage solution architect used to ask back the customer, hey, you know what application you have? You have an OLTP, you have an what kind of database, or you, it's a file storage, what is your IOPS requirement? You tell us. Based on that, we would decide whether it's RAID 10, RAID 01, or RAID 1, RAID 0, RAID 5, RAID 6, all those things. And then the plan capacity and place the order, receive the system, rack system, configure cluster, and all those things. Now, ta-da, you don't have to do all these things. You just have to provision volumes, mount volumes, and use it. Okay. Now, one thing is where the Azure regions are not available, then you have an option to create an CVO by yourself. It's like little, it's not that complicated. You require a managed services account and you require subscription and you require VMs. Everything is provided. That's a simple thing. But only thing is that you've got to deploy the software, configure cluster, provision aggregates, provision tenant, and then you would have an ability to do manage the performance, manage upgrades, provision and mount volumes. This is good. The only thing is that the max you can go per volume is 360 terabyte, and they're still working to increase. Once it crosses 360 terabyte, you have to switch to other ones, right? These have changed the way the whole storage is available in the cloud for large mission critical applications, and this is the foundation for those. Now, there is one kind of special storage. In one of my previous masterclass, we talked about high performance computing, right? For that, you need parallel, high performing, high available storage. Even though the ANF Ultra and the premium supports that kind of speed and all these things, there's one more option that is available. Is it's in the preview right now. That's why you would see a preview tab. But it's again, you would have an option based on how much storage capacity you want and how much throughput you want, and it would actually give you, it would design the whole thing for you. But the one thing with this is Azure Managed Lustre File System is that it's the world's most popular open source parallel distributed file system. In on-prem, if you have to do, build this, it's so expensive. To have multiple nodes, huge network backbone, because the certain activities of like caching, catering the reads, catering the writes, all those functionalities or the activities of a storage are distributed across individual systems so they can parallelly process and give you that high performance. So they took that architecture and now ported that to the cloud, which is like, wow, you would actually get, because somebody is doing it for you, and you all you have to do is subscribe and get this. And they already integrated into the other functions of Azure, made the management simple. It's enables things to pave forward. But at the end of the day, everything has a cost. But while cost is other factor, because there are use cases where it's worth the cost. Specifically in the research space, it's all about time to market. You have an idea and you want to test it, and you need high performance a compute or high performance storage to test that idea, because if you have to fail fast, but you so that you can learn from that failure and move on. So these kind of enterprise options is changing the way today the industry is moving, and the way IT is supporting is totally tremendous. So with that, I go with references and questions, but that's all I have. Thank you. Any questions?
Excellent. Thank you so much. It's a good background of Azure I was not aware of. But that's in the process of me having to learn Azure also. So great job. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Awesome. Aline, are you ready?
I am. Can you hear me?
Take it away.
All right. Can you hear me?
Yes.
All right.
Sounds great.
Can you see my screen?
Yes. Yeah, definitely. Looks good.
Great. So I'm Aline from the analytics department. I'm just graduating from Bachelor in Analytics, and I'm going to talk about how to develop your analytics skills. I know you all put in your resume that you have great analytics skills, critical think, but by the end of this presentation, you might think you are not that good as you think you are. So what inspired me to choose this topic was the Dr. Priest's presentation in April 4th, 2003. I know have a lot of interns that watched the presentation. The new interns, I highly recommend you all to go watch it, because that presentation is gold. Like all her presentations, but that one in specific. So just to refresh with that presentation that she said why you were here. And like the intern, and she said they were here to connect the nodes between projects to one a skill set. And that she observed that we would finish a course and move on to another course and not transfer the knowledge and do not connect all the knowledge from course to course. We would only fulfill the rubrics, and we could not build a product on our own. And then she said we have to have a creative analytical developer mindset. And here we are to talk about that. And I'm going to connect a lot of her insights to this presentation. So I'm going to be very repetitive sometimes. And again, go watch when you have a chance. Analytic skills describe our ability to understand and solve problems using the information we have available. Analytics skills refer to the ability to research, collect, and analyze information to form more complex ideas about it. Using analytics skills is a great way to develop solutions for complex problems and interpret data to gain more knowledge about the subject. So when you go online and you see tips for developing your analytical abilities, you're going to find read more, build your mathematical skills, be more observant, ask questions. These are all true. However, I found something interesting that I think the main point was not that. That is like part of being an intelligent human being is the desire to learn the truth about the world we live in. So what people want you to do when you are analyzing data is to present them with a thoughtful, fact-based point of view. Again, fact-based point of view. When it comes to the workplace, employees want to know that you are able to think on your feet, solve complex problems, and gather information to make rational decisions and consider your next step. So employers want to know that you are not only able to get information, but articulate it and solve complex problems. But rely on a personal experience and information provided by others to develop an individual version of the truth. Consequently, a personal truth is vulnerable to subjective and the quality of the information available. And to make things worse, the fact that you are intentionally provided misleading information to arrive at conclusions they are not true, unfortunately, all too often this information is presented in statistical form. So this comes up with the main challenge when you talk about analytics and building your analytics skill, that is bias. Bias are the main challenge with analytics. So let's give you a simple example. Like, would you follow, when you think of GPS, would you follow your GPS anywhere? Like, you put your address at your GPS, and could you follow the GPS blindly where it tells you to go? Like, even into a lake. I mean, that may sound ridiculous, but a quick Google search brings up dozens of cases where drivers drove into lakes and rivers because the GPS instructed them to. So following GPS instruction against your better judgment is one example of automation bias. As humans, we have many biases, both implicit and explicit. So biases are systematic errors in thinking influenced by cultural and personal experience. Biases distort our perception and cause us to make incorrect decisions. One bias that many humans share is automation bias. Automation bias stems from the idea that computers or machines are more trustworthy than humans because they are more objective. Automation bias is at the root of why people follow the GPS into trouble, even when contradictory information is available. And now I'm going to make a connection with the presentation of Doc when she said that we are humans and we are analog. And unfortunately, we are becoming way, way more digital, like the music is digital, a lot of things are digital, and she even showed a graph shown the difference of analog and digital. Also played a video to illustrate how we have capabilities that machines don't have. And that is very true. And that is an example that why we should not give up of our analog skill. So computers, data, and algorithms are not actually completely objective. It is true that data analysis can help us make better decisions, but it's not immune to bias. Humans create technology and algorithms. As a result, they often have human biases encoded into them. Similarly, we need to look at more information sources when we evaluate data analysis results or report. If you want to be responsible when you use data and algorithms, we need to understand the different types of bias that show up at each stage of analyzing data. So let's start with bias in data collection, because we forget that before we can analyze data or use machine learning algorithms, we need to collect data. Data collection is subject to selection bias, also called sample bias. Selection bias occurs when the sample is not representative of the population. Selection bias can be due to poor study design if the sample is too small or is not randomized. So there is this article from 2018 that highlights how Amazon produced a machine learning algorithm that suffered from such a selection bias. The company designed the algorithm to help recruiters hire top talent. The model was trained on thousands of resumes from people there were or were not hired by Amazon. So it learned 50,000 phrases associated with resumes and began to ignore common phrases such as the names of programming languages. But the algorithm also learned to downgrade resumes that contain the word women's. This included resumes that referenced women's colleges, teams, or committees. Pretty much the new recruiting engine did not like women. But it's not that people programming and there was intentionally to be sexist. No. This is an example of selection bias because the data used to train the algorithm were not representative enough. The majority of Amazon's past applicants and employees were male. This means that a large proportion of the successful resumes in the training data came from male applicants. So Amazon did not explicitly train the algorithm to use gender, but yet the algorithm is still found and used gender-associated terms to weed out women candidates. This is why we need to do our best to avoid bias by doing everything possible to have a representative sample, not just a convenient one, but this is, of course, it's easier said than done. So when we talk about bias in interpreting results and drawing conclusions, of course, bias also influences the final stage of data analysis. Interpreting results and drawing conclusions, evaluating or generating the report, all of that is going to be affected. So we have confirmation bias, that is our tendency to seek out information that supports our views. Confirmation bias influences data analysis when we consciously or unconsciously interpret results in a way that supports our original hypothesis. And here I'm going to link again Doc's presentation where she said, why have we become so conspiratorial and influenced by social media? It's very binary, and humans are not naturally binary. I agree 100% with her. Right now, social media are killing our analytic skills. We are living in a bubble. We only follow people that we agree with. We only want to hear things that's going to support our point of views. When someone posts something that we don't like, we unfriend that. It can be friends of many years. We unfriend them. We unfollow someone that posts content that we like only because one simple post. And this made us very binary. So to limit confirmation bias, clearly state hypotheses and goals before starting an analysis, and then honestly evaluate how they influenced our interpretation and reporting of results. Then we have overgeneralization bias. is inappropriately extending observations made with one data set to other data sets, leading to overinterpreting results and unjustified extrapolation. To limit overgeneralization bias, be thoughtful when interpreting data. Only extend results beyond the data set used to generate them when it is justified, and only extend results to the proper population. We have reporting bias. It's the human tendency to only report or share results that affirm our beliefs or hypotheses, also known as positive results. Editors, publishers, and readers are also subject to reporting bias as positive results are published, read, and cited more often. To limit reporting bias, report negative results and cite others who do too. So data and machine learning algorithms are now everywhere. They influence decisions about who is hired or fired, accept into schools, or allowed to rent houses. So we must recognize that data and algorithms can be biased, just like the humans who create and train them. It is crucial for us to learn more about the types of bias that influence how algorithms function will improve our ability to perform and interpret data analysis and will help us make more informed decisions. So, again, I'm gonna make a link with her presentation, talk presentation, and she made a point that people are talking about like artificial intelligence, neural network imitates the human mind. And she said, no, they don't, that is impossible. And I agree with her. And I even gonna add that I think that humans there are the ones that are trying to imitate being like artificial intelligence algorithm, trying to become way too objective. And we ended up, you know, with the automation bias, like when we pushed more the these tools, you know, neural network, NLP, algorithm, artificial intelligence, we trust more these tools than in your own brain. And if you are not diligent, as she said, we will lose a valuable analog nutrition to our brain. We have a creative analytic developer mindset, not this machine. Otherwise, we are going to become one of those people who just fulfill the minimum. If you're not, put your brain to work. So in reality, bias is in building an optimized algorithm. Algorithmic bias arises when an algorithm produces systematic and repeatable errors that lead to unfair outcomes, such as privileging one group over another. So we can't rely 100% on artificial intelligence. Machine learning and all these tools, many times they are wrong, and we are the ones who have the ability to catch their mistakes. So we should not fear our job like nowadays of people, programmers, they all fear, you know, how many jobs is going to be taken away because artificial intelligence is going to start to do that. But we should not fear our job if you have great analytic skills. So just a simple joke. Because there is this meme from ChatGPT that I found on the internet, and I thought that is funny. So I'm letting you guys read, because I think it would be funny if you guys read yourself. As you can see, we can find many mistakes. Of course, they probably already fixed that. They are always every day fixing, but we cannot rely 100% in those tools. We still have to rely in our brain, in our analytic skills. We have to, you know, exercise your brain and we cannot lose. Like she said, you know, become zeros and ones, zeros and ones, zeros and ones, and lose our capabilities. They're way more advanced of this artificial intelligence. So right now, as went through all of that, the main thing that you guys are not gonna like, but I need to be the bad guy to break this to you, is that there is no analytical skills without statistics. I know many of you hate statistics, struggle in school, learn statistics in school, in universities, challenging because we have a lot of content, you know, and we have to test and the, you know, deadlines. It can be very overwhelming, but we have to give it a try, especially the basics, because coming here, I'm going to even read it here from a statistic book, one of the books, like, to intelligently appreciate or produce statistical information, you must be statistically literate to defend yourself from a persuasive but fallacious statistic argument. To decrease your vulnerability to pseudoscience and to diminish the chances of making poor and sometimes interpersonal decisions. So let's think about it. When you see a data set, do you ask yourself, where did the data come from? How is it sampled? And is the sample large enough? How reliable or accurate would the measure used to generate the reported data? Are the reported statistics appropriate for this kind of data? Is a graph drawn appropriately? How is this probabilistic statement calculated? Do the claims make sense? Now do a self-evaluation and ask yourself when you see data, when you see information in front of you, if you ask these questions and if you know how to verify these questions. Because if you don't know, I mean, we see graphs all the time, we see visualizations all the time. We have millions of data produced every minute and all this data is gathering statistical information. And if you don't have the ability to see, you know, should that data set be, we use mean, median, mode? Did that data set have missing values, outliers? So you have to ask this question and have the, to know that you have to have the ability to answer and to verify this question. And you only are able to know basics in statistics. So you don't want to, when you draw a graph or even build a visualization, how do you know that visualization that someone is presenting to you, could be a boss, could be a coworker, someone is presenting to you, how are you going to verify that? You only be able to verify and build your analytics skills if you know statistics. I'm sorry to deliver this bad news, but it's very important. And especially those that are in the analytics internship. That is crucial. You have to master that statistics. Python is important, Power BI is important, but an employee or anybody, they don't want to know if you know that. They want to know how we solve a problem using that. You know, how you build. And to begin to build a project, we first need a data set. Then you have to connect the nodes in that data set. And then you have to think, what statistical calculation should I apply? When we see the Amazon example, you know, there is a statistic mistake. And with a basic statistic mistake, and yet people from Amazon made because they didn't have a good sample. And this is a very basic statistics. In research, you need to have a good sample of the population, randomized. This sample should be randomized. If you don't have these skills, you don't have analytic skills. So this is why it's very important especially that we speak data nowadays, but we do not know how to interpret correctly if we don't know statistics. So to finish up, I like this quote. I tried to find the true author, but there was, when you put on Google, there is 1 billion people who shows up. So I don't know who is the real one. So you must always be willing to truly consider evidence that contradicts your belief and admit the possibility that you may be wrong. Intelligence, it isn't knowing everything. The ability to challenge everything you know. So that's it for me. Oops, no. Thank you.
That was so awesome.
All right.
Definitely. Great job.
So, Eileen, with the Amazon data, did they apply an F-test to determine whether their statistical model actually fit the data? Or
no.
did they even apply analysis to their population to determine whether it was normal distributed or not? Because that's how you're, if you don't know that, you can't actually do a good statistical analysis.
Yeah, exactly. And I can share the article with you guys.
Yeah,
and
if you would, because I'll take a look at it.
Yeah, and they only kept that later on. Like it was a simple, as I said, it was a simple basic statistic mistake when they train an algorithm without a good data, a good sample. Like if you have already not good sample, like if most of your sample are from male, of course the algorithm taught itself that, wait, that must be because women aren't good. So
right, that probably means that the data was actually, it was not normal distributed, it was actually skewed. So no matter what you sample, you're going to get an incorrect run. And boy, doing these normal distribution statistics is not fun.
Yeah. But this is why it's important to us to know and understand, because we don't want to make these mistakes and we don't want to analyze things incorrectly.
Well, that was a great job. Absolutely wonderful.
Thank you.
Nice deep diving into analytics, just so everybody understands. You might have the wrong information right now. I like the little test you gave us, because it's always those things that I get wrong and I'm thinking, okay, so Mike's mom has four kids, and I forget Mike is one of the names.
Right. You have to break it down into the names and realize, oh, there's four names.
Yeah, it's been given to us. And to me, that's the kind of things that pass right by me. And I'm like, wait, I got to read it 5 more times. Okay, I got it. Takes me a minute or so. All right. Well, excellent job. Very good. Very good. So now I'm going to present for 2 of the students. I'll go ahead and do Sydney. She has a presentation that is narrated for us. And make sure that I get it right. And I show. It don't start. No. I wasn't ready. I didn't do what everybody else is supposed to do. Okay, here we go.
Hello, my name is Sydney Pearson, and welcome to my master class on how Star Trek and entertainment shape the technology we have today. Now, this is going to be my first master class, so bear with me if I talk too slow or talk too fast. I am Before we can get to the technology we have today, we have to start with how the show itself came to be. We can all thank that to Mr. Gene Roddenberry, who coincidentally was a World War II pilot that worked for the Los Angeles Police Department before he started to write a TV show. Sure, he did create the short-lived series called The Lieutenant, but in 1966, before man even thought about going to the moon, the DSLU studios picked up the show that would not only change how we see things, but the world itself. And because of this studio that took a chance on a man, we are going to get the show that has helped us create and define many technologies we have today. Star Trek itself as a whole comes in many different interpretations. Whether you're a fan from the original series, the Star Trek Next Generation, or you even watch the movies, you know, there's some form of your life that has seen Star Trek, no matter what iteration it is. Or you could watch Stargate or Star Wars, but you know the concept of, and the show came first. It was the pioneer of many technologies that we have today. Not only that, it was a very innovative show because it had a wide variety of cast. You know, from black, white, Asian, male, it didn't matter if they were female, male, you know. It was a groundbreaking show that even had the first interracial kisses on TV. Something not a lot of people know because they just think of it as a nerd show that didn't really do much. But they're wrong. And I'm going to show you how a lot of people think that being nerds or loving a show made for nerds proved that we have the technology today because of shows like this. Now, some of the main focuses for this masterclass, I'm going to be talking about cell phones, cybernetics, medical advancements, and data and AI, all of which we have used, seen, or even looked at. But do we know where the inspiration has come from? Do we know where our cell phone, the groundwork for our cell phone came from? The inspiration behind it. Do we know the inspiration for cybernetics or, you know, some of the cool medical advancement we have today was because of this show? And it makes me sad that people sometimes don't know that the first thing I'm going to talk about is the telecommunicator. It was the device that every kid wished they had, that they could talk to their ground crew in order to be beamed back up to the USS Enterprise. You know, it was a device that would change the way of how we communicate with a person. And as you can see on the left, that is what the telecommunicator is. Kind of reminds me of an old flip phone, if you think about it. And Martin Cooper, who's actually head communication systems at the division of Motorola, got inspired by the telecommunicator because he believed that people are fundamentally inherently mobile. Which he's correct. Today's day and age, everyone is on the go, no matter where you are. Always walking, moving. We have our cell phones in our back pockets for everything. It's a small computer. And because of Star Trek, we can now FaceTime each other from halfway across the globe, talk to one another, send emails, something that was purely seen as fictional on TV. We could now do because of Mr. Cooper. Because of him, it inspired him to create the lovable brick from the 80s that weighed a lot, and that is that kind of also gets a lot of flack for being the ridiculous phone you see on TV. But without that ridiculous phone, or without the groundwork, we wouldn't have our cell phones we have today. And we have Star Trek to thank for that. Now, unfortunately, I have never watched Star Trek Next Generation. It's not because I don't want to. It's because I like the original cast, and it's hard for me to try to get in touch with new characters. But I kind of wish I did, because the Next Generation gave us Data. Data was the crew's first fully functional android in Star Trek The Next Generation. He performed many functions and related to a lot of people who felt, well, robotic. He and a lot of other people in Generations were people could see themselves in. If you watch The Big Bang Theory, you'll probably think of Sheldon when you look at Data and how he speaks. In one episode, he even cosplays Adam as him, and it's just impressive of how advanced he is. Now, unfortunately, we don't have the fully equipped androids we want today, but we are making strides in cybernetics in order to help people continue and regain something they once lost. If you have a relative or a person you know has gone through an amputation, it's a hard feeling not having your limb there. You feel incomplete. But because of cybernetics, you know, they have the ability to have their hand back or their foot. You know, seeing wires hooked up to a person's nervous system in order to make fingers move, that is so cool. Or just even a simple small hook on the hand, you know, that grabs things. All because of Star Trek. This wouldn't be possible without the show. And that's what a lot of people tend to forget. When you watch Star Trek, the one thing that a lot of people tend to flock to was the medical bay. Bones was the team's lead medical expert, and he used the tricorder, which you can see on the left, not only diagnose a patient, but lead the way towards the medical advancement we know today. My favorite quote from one of the movies I saw was when they go back in time and Bone uses a tricorder on a woman, and he gives her a pill in order to help her regrow a kidney, you know, and just, it's just an amazing concept, because we're already kind of experimenting with that today when it comes to regrowing certain organs. And the tricorder, it's not only a fictional thing, it actually it's a real item we have today. On the right, you'll see a glucose meter. Because of the tricorder, the glucose meter was able to get invented and help people like my mother, who is severely type 2 diabetic, make sure their blood sugars aren't too low or too high. It helps people survive. And we need to thank the show, because it saves lives. But people tend to not think about that when they look at shows like this. The last thing I'm going to talk about is Data and AI. You can see on the right, Data, there he is, with half his brain out, and you can see all the different hardware. but it proves the point about how data and AI go together. From OCI, AI has become a catch-all term for applications that perform complex tasks that once required human input, such as communicating with customers online or playing chess. The term is often used interchangeably with its subfields, which include machine learning and deep learning. Now, if you're a nerd like me, you probably understand why that can be terrifying and why AI is a little terrifying, because from ChatGPT, which can write full college papers that students can give and no one noticed, to self-driving cars, which can drive you anywhere and the driver not even touch a single handle or pedal. It is a new technology that is not only scary, but it's thriving. But there also is some good to AI, because without AI, we wouldn't have facial recognition or marketing chatbots to let us know how our, you know, site or project is doing, or to help us get us new customers. We have a lot to thank for data and AI. However, the big takeaway is that we don't need to let it get out of control and out of hand, because that leads to a whole new problem not many people tend to think about. The one thing people tend to not think about when it comes to shows like this and how technology is advancing is the lack of creativity. Shows like this paved the way for what we have today. And sometimes it's easy to take advantage or not give it the recognition it deserves. Without Star Trek, we probably wouldn't have our phones or our laptops or even just advancing into cloud or AWS. You know, we wouldn't be where we were today without shows like these. And that's what I wanted to explain, because without creativity, without the willingness to lay down the foundation for someone to make it better, it's just a standstill. You need creativity in order for your work to matter. And that's why I'm grateful for this show. I'm grateful that I got to experience the show, and I wish I could have lived through the technological advancements we have because of this show. And just because we're nerds or people in IT doesn't mean we don't have creativity within us. We can build something to be the next big thing. We always have that unlimited possibility. One of us may even, who knows, may figure out the code for teleportation. We just have to believe and work together in order to do that. Or get inspired to where you're just working and working nonstop. And it's all thanks to Mr. Gene Roddenberry and the show that nerds like us can do this. And I want to thank you all for attending this masterclass. I'm sorry if it wasn't good as my other presentators or, well spoken. I did my best and
you were awesome.
I hope you enjoyed it.
That was really good researching. Good job.
I agree. That was well put. She did a good job. All right. Now I have one from Nicholas Wolf, and it's the trivia game that he did. Let's see if it pops up. If it will open. All right. Can everybody see that?
Looks great.
All right. Here we go.
Hello, everybody. So for this presentation, I just wanted to go through the trivia game that I made for AC and DC. I wanted to go through the thought process behind making the game, go through the editor, show you everything that I customized, and show you the code and how everything works and interacts with each other. So my initial thought process when making this game was that I'm not going to be here for very much longer. So I wanted to make it really easy for future interns to just grab this project and change anything they needed to change without even needing to understand the code, really. So here in the start menu, you see the AC logo up top, the trivia game text, and the start button. Here in the main game, you see the score up at the top, the question area, the timer, the answers area, and the next button. So here, taking a look at the scripts. First thing we want to go over is this public class called Question. It derives from a scriptable object because scriptable objects store large amounts of data. And it also lessens the memory usage. And since AC and DC are big data loads anyway, I didn't want to bog down the traffic flow with this game, so that's why I made it derive from a scriptable object. Because within this class will be a lot of info. So here you see a lot of serialized fields and public getters. The serialized fields just are just to view whatever we need to in the inspector. Here we see the public getters. This just allows the other scripts to interact with this, whatever it may be. So for example, we make a question or an answers array right here, and then we make it public in case, let's say, the game manager needs to get this array, and then it will return it to the game manager. Here we see a list being made called Get Correct Answers. This just makes a new list called Correct Answers. It goes through, it loops through the answers in every question. And if it's correct, it adds it to a new list called Correct Answers. And then it returns that correct answer. So here in the game manager script, we need to make a question array. Then we need to make a new list called Picked Answers. These are just the answers that the user picked. We also need to make a new list called Finished Questions. These are all the questions that the user have already done. So the first thing we need to do every time a game starts, we need to call this Erase Answers method. This basically just gets that Picked Answers list and it grabs everything inside of it and just deletes it all. Start off with a new slate. So all of the answers will get their information in this answer data script. Here you see some headers and some serialized fields. These are just to view them in here. See the references and the UI elements you saw right here. This is where this was created. You also see one called game events. This derives from this script right here. The game events script is where we store all the callbacks. This mainly is for whenever we want to update the resolution screen. Right here, we want to update the score. We want to update the answer or the question. So whenever another script wants to communicate with this game event script, it will invoke these delegates that we made. So for example, if you want to display a new question, the UI manager will contact the game event script. It will invoke this delegate and it will get this callback and it will be able to display the updated question. So back in our game manager script, we want to go to the display method. This is where we call that erase answers method to start off with a clean slate. Then we make a new variable called question, and it calls the get random question method. Within this method, we make a new variable called random index. And in order for us to display a random question, we need to get the index of that question. So this is why we made this method right here, the get random question index. And here we make a new variable called random. We throw a if statement on here to check if all the questions have been finished. If there are more questions that need to be finished, we make the random variable equal to a random range of 0 and the question's array length. This will just grab one of the questions within that array randomly. But we also want to make sure that those questions are not also in the finished questions list or equal to the current question, because we don't want to repeat any questions. They all just want to go through one time and that's it. So get the index, get it right here, and then we set the current question to that index, and then we return the question array. And then back up here, we make that question display right here. And then this is just an error log to make sure that the question was not null, meaning there was a question. If there wasn't a question, something went wrong, and it will display this debug.log. So whenever we start a new game, we don't want to display all of the questions all at one time. We want to display them one at a time. So that's why we have to make a new method called loadQuestions. In this method, it will make a new object array. It will equal to the resources folder. And then it will loop through all of those questions in that folder and just add them to the array. The folder that I am talking about is in here, in the resources, and then in questions. And then here are all the new questions. Now we can start talking about some of the UI elements. Here you see a lot of parameters and serialized fields. These are all just same thing as the questions script. We're just getting all of the elements and things and putting them in an inspector. For example, the background colors. Down here we see parameters for the answers content area, the question text, score text, and all those UI elements that we need. So along with creating the questions, we have to create the answers as well. To do that, we start by calling this erase answers method. This does the exact same thing as the other one. It's just that one was for the questions. This one is for the answers. So in here, you will see the erase answers method. So we start off with a clean slate, a offset to just make the display look a little better. Right here, we make a for loop that loops through all of the questions' answers, and then it puts them into an answer prefab. We instantiate this prefab, and then we parent that prefab to the answers content area. The reason why we do this, and the reason for most of this right here, these are all just like positionings and things like that. But the reason why we instantiate this is because if we don't do that, all the answers will just stack up on top of each other in the answers area, and it won't be readable. So we want to spread them out by instantiating that prefab and then making that prefab go into different positions in the answer area. And then we display those answers. So now that we have all of the answers and questions updated and loaded and displaying, how does the game randomize those questions and answers every time we start a new game? For that, we go up here into the start method in the game manager script. We make a new variable called seed. We make a random range of a minimum value and a maximum value, and then we initialize that seed randomly. This basically just means if I were to put 0 and 10 right here, this just grabs a random number from that range and then initializes that here. This way, every single time the game starts, it will just be a random iteration of the questions and answers. That way somebody doesn't just memorize the whole thing, just, you know, set a high score every single time they play. So how does the game know if the answer is correct or not? For that, we go to this accept method. Now, there's a lot going on in this accept method, but first we look at this bool that I created is correct. It calls the checked answers method, which is down here. So within this checked answers method, we have to make another method called compare answers. And here, we make an if statement with the parameters of picked answers.count is greater than 0. This just means if there are answers picked. We create two new lists, one for correct answers and then one for the picked answers. We're already getting the correct answers in the question script right here. So we have to make a reference to the questions script and then call that method. And then here we create a new picked answers list determined by which answer the user selects. Add that to the list, and then we compare those two lists. We compare the correct answers list to the picked answers and vice versa. And then depending on whether or not it is correct or incorrect, we return the resolution screen state that the question or the answer relates to. Like if the answer was correct, it will show the correct resolution screen state, or it will display the wrong one. So after that, we go back up to our accept method. After it checks the answers, compares them, it will add that question to the finished questions list. It will update the score. It will also make a new variable. This just means this just displays the right resolution screen whenever the user clicks that next button. You might have noticed this set high score method. This basically just means in this method, it just says if the resolution screen is the finished type, we will display this final background color. We will display the final score. We will also check if there is a new high score. And we do this by going into this game utility script and we go to the save pref key. What this basically does is stores the last highest score. And if it is new, we display the word new in yellow text right before we display the high score and the actual score. I'll show you what that looks like here in a minute. So how does the game determine whether or not the game's finished? For that, we go right here, and the is finished bool. We say, are the finished questions less than the questions array length? If it is, there's more questions that need to be answered. And if it's greater than, then there's no more questions to display. So the game's over and that final screen will show. So let's take a look at the actual functionality of the game. And we click start. You see immediately the timer pops up, starts playing the countdown. You hear the music start, and then you see the question and answers being displayed. And then if you click on an answer, click next, you see the resolution screen popped up. It said correct answer plus 10. Now we have 10 score. Then you see the timer pop back up. There we got a wrong one. It says wrong. Minus 10. And then if we just go through all of these really quickly, I don't know all of the answers. We will eventually get to that final screen. Okay, so here is the final screen. You see the final score, the score that I got. And then you see the high score being displayed. Now, if this was a new high score, you would see yellow text right here saying new, and it would match the current score. Then, if the user wants to play again, they hit play again, and then a brand new seed will show, and more randomized questions. So here I want to demonstrate kind of how a new intern would just get this project and add a new question if they needed to, or delete them. Right here, if we right-click one of the questions that are already made, you see this delete. They can literally just delete any of these if they need to. Or there's this create button. You go up here, and then you go to quiz, and then you go to new question. Over here on the right, you see info, where you can type your question in. So we'll do, is the sky blue? And then right here where it says zero, you can put however many answers you want. We'll do 4. We'll make yes, no, maybe, so. And then whatever answer is correct, you make sure you click this checkbox right here. And then down here, you click this check mark if you want to use the timer. You set the time you want the timer to have. And then for this one, you check to see if, does this question have multiple answers to it, or is it just a single answer? For our question, it's just a single. And then right here, you set what you want the score to be. And that new question gets added to this folder. And then eventually, the question will pop up here. So hopefully we get it pretty quickly here. Just to be able to demonstrate it. You see how it's randomized? The new question that we just made is actually the first question in the folder, but we didn't get that question yet, so it's completely randomized. And here's our new question that we just made. And then if we click yes, it is correct. So that's trivia game. If anybody has any questions, let me know. Otherwise, I thank you for your time. And have a great day.
Another awesome job.
That was awesome. And we were so waiting to find out about the trivia game. I love it. I love it. I love it. You came up with your own trivia game. Nicholas, are you still here?
Yeah, I'm here.
Awesome. Does anybody have any questions for Nicholas? You actually answered my question because I was thinking, where's, you know, the questions coming from? Is it making up itself? But you showed us at the bottom, you can make all the questions for there. So, and there's no limit, obviously, right? You can put as many questions as you want.
Yep, exactly.
So now that we have a trivia game, we need to think how we can use this in other areas of our projects. And it can be made again and again and again. That's awesome. Very good job. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, everybody did excellent this evening. There's some great presentations. I mean, really, everybody did great at presenting. So feel good about what you've created and what you've come up with. And I look forward to next week with some more great presentations. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. And hope you have a great rest of your evening. And great weekend. Have a good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Night.
Good night.
Good night, everybody.